The book of Daniel kind of covers the whole period of the Babylonian Empire when it's in its strength. In 605 BC, it's kind of a critical year for the book of Daniel. In 605 BC, in May or June, around May and June of that year, a general of the Babylonian army named Nebuchadnezzar finished his campaign against the Assyrian Empire and finally had victory over the Assyrians, who were the last big guys on the block. He conquered them at Carchemish. It was a big, huge historical battle at Carchemish when he fought against the Assyrians and their allies, the Egyptians. And after the battle, when the battle is over, he heads south chasing the Egyptian army back to Egypt. And Carchemish is up in modern Syria. And so if you go from Syria down to Egypt, guess where you go through? You go through the land of Israel, the land of Palestine. And as he gets into Palestine, he gets word that his papa, Nebuchadnezzar or something like that, and his pop happens to be the king of Babylon. And he hears that his pop dies. And so he travels back to Babylon, gets crowned king, and then comes back and finishes what he was doing. Comes back to Palestine, lays siege to Jerusalem, and they just kind of roll over and say, "Okay, we'll follow you. You're our Lord. We'll follow you." And that begins. That's one of the time marks in 605, and it happens around September, is where what we call the first wave of the exile. He will take a few of the implements from the temple and take them back to Babylon. And he will take a few choice people with him. And that begins our story. Chapter 1 of Daniel, verse 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the articles of the house of God, which he carried to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God. Land of Shinar is Babylon. And he brought the articles into the treasure house of his God. Now, as I mentioned, this is the first wave of the Babylonian captivity. The second wave will happen in 597 BC, 7 years later, or maybe that's 8 years later. Nebuchadnezzar, because the people in Jerusalem kind of rise up and decide they don't want to follow Nebuchadnezzar anymore, and he comes back and, you know, shakes a few swords and he captures them again. He takes their current king, Jehoiachin, captive, takes him back along with 10,000 other captives, including, do you remember anybody famous that goes in the second wave? Ezekiel, our buddy that we've just been studying and we just finished his book last week. Ezekiel goes in the second wave. So when Ezekiel gets to Babylon, Daniel's already been there for 7 or 8 years. Then the final blow happens in 586 BC, which is another, 11, 12 years later, where, again, the Jews have rebelled against Babylon again, and they come, and he comes one last time, and that's the time where he totally wipes out the place, totally levels it. The temple is completely destroyed, and he takes some of the people back, and there aren't very many left after he's done. Now, this whole thing where he takes this first wave of captivity that includes Daniel and some of the stuff from the temple actually is a fulfillment of a prophecy. I don't know if you recall the story, but when King Hezekiah was the king of Judah, of the southern kingdom, those were the days of Isaiah the prophet. And there was a time when Hezekiah got real sick and then God healed him, and it was a miracle. And then all kinds of people wanted to find out and visit Hezekiah and say, "Wow, what a cool thing God did." And some of the people that visited him were the ambassadors from Babylon. And he thought these were cool guys. Hezekiah did. These are great guys. And he was impressed by them, and he showed them everything he had. He took them through the vault and took them through the crown jewels and showed them all the secrets of his kingdom, because he just wanted to impress these people. And after they left, the prophet Isaiah said, "You know what, buddy? These same people will one day carry away your treasures and your offspring." And so in 605 BC, that's when it started. It actually was a fulfillment of a prophecy. It's kind of interesting. Verse 3. Aren't you just glad you heard that? Okay, good. I'm glad. Thank you, Kyle. Okay. The king, verse 3, the king instructed Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel and come, and some of the king's descendants and some of the nobles. So that's the people that he takes from Israel. And it's been suggested that Daniel is one of the, he calls them, the king's descendants. We think that Daniel may have been in the line of David. He may have been related to the kings. Verse 4, he takes young men in whom there was no blemish. And we think that Daniel's around 15, 16 years old at this time. They're good-looking kids, you know. I can think of a Daniel that's about that age that fits that. He's good-looking. Gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge, and quick to understand, who had ability to serve in the king's palace and whom they might teach the language and literature of the Chaldeans. And the king appointed for them these captives that he's taken. He's taken the cream of the crop of the nation. These young kids that can just, such potential. The king appointed for them a daily provision of the king's delicacies and of the wine which he drank, and 3 years of training for them so that at the end of that time they might serve before the king. So, Nebuchadnezzar, that's actually quite ingenious. He's got this idea of how he's going to run this empire, this world empire of his. And what he does is he takes the best of each nation that he conquers, and he's got kind of like a university leadership training program thing. And he takes these kids and he brings them to Babylon and immerses them in Babylonian culture. And he's going to teach them, give them the best of education, and then put them in charge of his empire. Give them the jobs, let them run the government. And it's actually pretty ingenious. It's a good way of, you know, who better to know how to handle the Jews under his control than if he raises up Jews in his own government. That's pretty smart, actually. Now, from among those of the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. To them, the chief of the eunuchs gave names. He gives them new names. He hands out name tags at the introductory thing, you know, at the introductory tea, and they're all eating tea and crumpets, and he gives them all name tags, and their names aren't on them. There's other names on them. He gives them different names. He says, he gave Daniel the name Belteshazzar, to Hananiah, Shadrach, to Mishael, Meshach, and to Azariah, Abednego. So he gives these guys all new names. And what's the deal here? He's immersing them in Babylonian culture. He's taking away their Jewish heritage. He's changing their names. Their names are all very godly names. Daniel's name means God is my judge. Dan means judge. The I means my, and El is God. God is my judge, Daniel. And he changes his name to Belteshazzar. Now, don't confuse him with the guy Belshazzar. That's another guy later on in the book. But Daniel's called Belteshazzar. He's got a belt. He's not just a ding-dong Belshazzar. He's a Belteshazzar. And his name either means, this is an exact science, translation, exact science. It either means Lord of the Straitened Treasure or Lady Protect the King. I tell you, it's just an exact science, it's translation stuff. Okay, Hananiah gets the name Shadrach. Hananiah, his name means God has favored. God has favored. Or actually, God has graced, because Hanan is the word for grace. Hananiah, that's God has graced. Or actually, Yahweh has graced. Shadrach means the great scribe, or I am fearful of a God. Okay? Mishael. I like this name. I like this. It would be a great name for a kid. Maybe we could have some more kids, and we can name this. Mishael is a great name. It means who is like God. Isn't that great? Who is like God? I like that name, Mishael. And then change his name to Meshach, which means either guest of a king or I am despised, contemptible, humbled before my God. Okay. Azariah, Azar means help. Yahweh is my help. Azariah, that was his name. And they turned his name to Abednego. Now, I heard some people translate this to off to bed you go. when the little kids, they tell the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and off to bed you go. But it's really Abednego. And his name, I only find one translation, servant of Nebo. Not Nemo, that's the little fish. Servant of Nebo. So the idea is to change these guys, to make them, to take them out of church and make them worldly guys. You know, to give them cool, ungodly names. To help change their way of thinking, to make them more Babylonian. That's the idea. Verse 8. But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore, he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. He didn't. He just had a hard time with this program. And it's not just education. I mean, it's everything. You know, they get the names. Okay, I'll do the name thing, you know. But where he really had a problem was with the diet that they were making them eat. He called it the king's delicacies. Now, what's the big deal? What, he didn't like, you know, chocolate eclairs or something? You know, I don't know, what's his problem? I'm not sure that they're chocolate eclairs. There's a few things in the Jewish dietary laws that good Jewish boys are not supposed to eat. For example, eating meat that still has the blood in it. They didn't like that. God said, don't do that. When you make a sacrifice and when you or kill an animal for meat, you drain the blood. And in fact, eating blood, God said, I don't want you to do that because blood is special. I want blood only used for sacrifice because the life, God says in Leviticus, the life is in the blood. And there's a whole purpose for that because, see, one day God's Son would shed His blood. He would give His life for us. God just doesn't want to messing with that. You know, He doesn't want us to treat blood like Jell-O. You know, let's have some Jell-O for dessert. You know, well, let's have blood for dessert. You know, God says, no, don't do that. Because I want you to think of blood in a special way. Well, it may have been something like that. It may have been that maybe they had bacon for breakfast every day, you know, and good Jewish boys don't eat pork. The ham sandwiches. You know, and pork chops for dinner, you know, and maybe something like that. Even things like, I'm glad I'm not Jewish because I have to give up shrimp. Shrimp is unclean to the Jews, you know, and so it may be something like that. I was thinking another thing is that maybe the king's buffet table looked like the buffet table in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. Remember that, where the little worms are crawling in the plates of worms and the monkey with the eyeballs and stuff? I would say no to that. Would you? Okay. He purposes in his heart not to do this. He says, you know what? I don't think I should be doing this. And he makes a resolution. You know, we're coming up on New Year's, and some people make New Year's resolutions. And sometimes we laugh at that because after you get to be an old fart like me, you realize that nobody ever keeps these things. You know, people make these resolutions and nobody ever follows through. But you know what? Resolutions, purposing in your heart is not all bad. If you purpose in your heart to do something, there's a chance you might do it. But if you never aim at something, if you never have a purpose in your life, you're not going nowhere. And so, you know, it's not the whole ball of wax. Purposing something in your heart, deciding I'm going to do this. But it's a start. It's a start. So Daniel says, you know what? I can't do this. He says he purposed in his heart. He would not defile himself. Verse 9. Now God had brought Daniel into the favor and goodwill of the chief of the eunuchs. The guy liked Daniel. He liked this kid. He's a great kid. I like this guy. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord, the king, who has appointed your food and drink. Why should he see your faces looking worse than the young men who are your age? Then you would endanger my head before the king. Now see, the guy likes his job, and his job is to feed these kids, and the king has decided what they should be eating, and the eunuch doesn't see any problem with that, and he's afraid that if the guys go off the diet, that they're gonna start looking, you know, all gaunt and skinny and, you know, wasted, you know, or something like that, and the guy's, he's not actually cared about Daniel. He's really worried about his own head. He's, because Nebuchadnezzar has a reputation, and he doesn't lose his head over things. Other people lose their heads over things. So he's a little worried about it. Verse 11. So Daniel said to the steward, whom the chief of the eunuchs had set over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days and let them give us vegetables to eat and water to drink. Now, I think there's something wrong with Daniel there. He says he wants vegetables. This is a teenager? Verse 13. Then let our appearance be examined before you, and the appearance of the young men who eat the portion of the king's delicacies. And as you see fit, so deal with your servant. Now, I like this. Daniel asks for a trial period. He doesn't try to talk Ashpenaz into it. He says, look, just give us a little trial, you know, and then you can decide. He doesn't, you know, try to guilt the guy into it or, argue with the guy. He says, just give us a little trial period. I like that. Test me. I think that it's a great thing to be able to persuade people through the power of your words, your logic, your arguments. I think that's a great thing, and I envy people who are good at that. I always think of the good arguments like 2 days later. I don't know. Are you like that? I'm like that. I'm not on the spot. Greg Senecal. He's just great. He's absolutely awesome. I'm not. If I'm in a discussion with somebody, I go home and I sleep on it, and I wake up in the middle of the night, and then I think, oh yeah, that's the reason, you know. I envy people who can think on their feet, who can give the arguments. But you know what, gang? I wonder if sometimes we, in envying people like that, I wonder if sometimes we don't forget the persuasive power of a life that is well lived. There is persuasive power in a life that is well lived. I think it's an excellent thing to say to people, especially people you're witnessing to. You know, I may not have all the answers right here for you right now, but while I'm looking up the answers, let me challenge you something. Look at my life. You see if it's different. Look at my life. I think some of us it'd be kind of scary to do that, huh? Well, look at my life, but not too close, you know. don't look too closely, you know. Don't put a microphone in, when I'm talking with my family, you know. I get mad sometimes, you know. Don't do that, you know. You know, gang, there is persuasive power in a life well lived. To say to somebody, test me. Give me 10 days. Look at my life. Jesus said, I have given you an example that you should do as I have done to you. That's what he said to his disciples. In other words, he said, you guys look at my life and do what I do. Step where I step. Say what I say. Do what I do. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 11:1, he said, imitate me just as I also imitate Christ. Same deal. Same deal. And you know what, gang? I think that's a great thing that we should be saying to people. You know, look at my life. Test me. Verse 14. So this guy, what's the guy's name who he's talking to? Is this Ashpenaz? Says he consented with them in this matter, and he tested them for 10 days. He said, what can it hurt? You know, 10 days. Okay. And at the end of 10 days, their features appeared better and fatter in flesh. Now, in those days, fatter was good. Okay? See, I'd be a really good guy. Okay? To see, you know, in those days, fatter was good. Now, in our days, you know, fat's not good. But fatter in those days meant you had meals to eat, you know, whereas most people didn't have meals to eat. They appeared fatter in flesh than all the young men who ate the portion of the king's delicacies. Guys, God's ways are best. God's ways are best. Sometimes sometimes we get the idea that God's just out to ruin everybody's fun. You know, if I'm going to be a good Christian, then I'm going to not have any fun at all. And is that true, Dan? God, you're just no fun being a Christian? No, you have way too much fun as a Christian, I know. You know, and sometimes we get the idea that God's ways are bad for us, but gang, they're for our good. They're for our health. There was a study done back in 1999, published in USA Today. It says the reward of going to church might be a longer wait for heaven. Regular worshipers live 10% longer than those who never attend services, says a national study to be published next month. Life expectancy for weekly churchgoers is 82, and 83 for those who attend more than once a week. That's for you guys. How about that? People come on Thursday night. You live longer. Well, we should put that, Lori, we should put that in the bulletin, you know? I mean, shoot. And then it says, non-churchgoers, the survey finds, live an average of 75 years. That's like 7 or 8 years less. When researchers adjusted the data for lifestyle factors such as weight and tobacco use, because you'd probably think, well, yeah, churchgoers don't smoke or drink, or I don't smoke, I don't chew, and I don't go with girls that do. But when they adjusted for that, non-worshippers still had the highest risk of early death. So isn't that interesting? You know what? Doing things God's way is best. And so after 10 days, Daniel and his buddies are doing better. They're more buff. They're just like, their eyes are clear. They're just answering all the questions at school. You know, they're acing all the exams, you know. And so verse 16, thus the steward took away their portion of delicacies and the wine that they were to drink and gave them vegetables. He says, well, this is good. Okay. As for these four young men, now I don't know if they made everybody else eat vegetables or not. Doesn't say that, but at least Daniel got to do what he needed to do. As for these four young men, God gave them knowledge and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. Now at the end of the days, when the king had said that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. This is their final exam at the end of the 3 years. This is how you pass, is you have to stand before the king and answer his questions. Then the king interviewed them, and among them all, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore, they served before the king. And in all matters of wisdom and understanding about which the king examined them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers who were in all his realm. Thus, Daniel continued until the first year of King Cyrus. Cyrus overthrew Babylon in 539, and that makes that says that Daniel lived into his 80s, at least. He lived to be an old man. Now, I like this. In all matters of wisdom and understanding, they were found 10 times better. Daniel and his pals were better than all the others. You know, some of us find a little too much comfort in the verse in 1 Corinthians 1. Where it says that God uses the foolish things to confound the wise. Some of us just find too much pleasure in that. We go, well, yeah, God could use a dope like me. Yep. And you know, that's okay. That's good. It is good to feel like even when you're dirt, that God can use you. Absolutely. But gang, there is a balance to this. And here's the balance. I think that there is a sense in which Christians ought to work better, ought to work smarter, ought to do better, because we're doing our best for God. And when God works in us, I think there's a sense that we're going to stand out. Charles Spurgeon, he's a British preacher back in the 1800s. He was like the Chuck Smith of London. And he had a school for training pastors. He put some of his materials into a book called Lectures to My Students. And in it, in one of the chapters, he talks about who ought to go into the ministry, who ought to be a pastor. He talks about how he would get these guys coming, sitting in his office and interviewed with him because they want to be a pastor. And he would talk about one fellow who came in, and the guy sat down. He was late for one thing. He was late to the appointment. And I sat down and they started talking, and Mr. Spurgeon asked him, why do you want to be in the ministry? And the guy said, well, I tried working in the grocery store and it didn't work out. They fired me. So I thought I would try to be a lawyer, but I just couldn't handle that. That didn't work out. So I thought, well, what the heck? Let's try the ministry. And Spurgeon showed him the door, because his philosophy, and there's a point that don't misunderstand me here. There's a point that God wants our best. Serving God is not something you do just because nothing else works, because you can't do anything else. God wants to use the best. I think that people who are in the full-time ministry, I think, ought to be people who would excel at anything. People who would be promoted in business because they're hardworking, because they have a good work ethic. I think that's the way it ought to be. I don't think ministry ought to be for people who just can't get a life anywhere else. And here with Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, they served the king. They were found to be 10 times better than everyone else. And you know what, gang? At work, I hope and pray that you will become the most valued employee where you are. Because you're serving your king. God wants to work in you. God wants to work through you. We're chapter 2. We're only going to do 2 chapters a week as we go through Daniel. I love Daniel too much. I'm going to go real slow through the book. I'm sorry. Well, not real slow, but okay. Verse 1. Now, in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. New story. New chapter, new story. In the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was so troubled that his sleep left him. Had a hard time sleeping. Had some bad dreams. Now, it might have been the pizza that he had. I don't know. I don't think so. Verse 2. Then the king gave the command to call the magicians, the astrologers, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans to tell the king his dream. Chaldeans were people that lived in Babylon. So they came and they stood before the king. These are his counselors. These are his staff. They're magicians, astrologers, and sorcerers. How's that? You think the guy's superstitious? You betcha. Verse 3, and the king said to them, I have had a dream, and my spirit is anxious to know the dream. And the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic, O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will give the interpretation. Now, just a real quick thing here. The book of Daniel is unique from other books of the Bible in that it is written in two different languages. Up to this point, it's been written in Hebrew. From this point, from the second half of verse 4 all the way through chapter 7, he switches to Aramaic. Aramaic, well, Hebrew is the language of the Jews. Aramaic was the language of the world. And he switches to Aramaic for these chapters because these chapters are primarily aimed at the Gentiles, the world. And that's the way God works, gang. God writes in your language. And so for this section here, while he's aiming at the world, and there's going to be prophecies about world kingdoms and all kinds of stuff, he's writing it in the Gentiles' language so they can understand it. Then after chapter 7, and the rest of it is written back in Hebrew. Anyway, so the Chaldeans say, well, okay, sir, we're here to help you. Yes, sir, okay, live forever. Now, what did you dream? And we'll interpret it. The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, my decision is firm. If you do not make known the dream to me, and its interpretation, you shall be cut in pieces, and your houses shall be made an ash heap. Now, if Nebuchadnezzar says that to you, you should start shaking, because he means it. That's exactly what he'll do. He'll cut you to pieces. Now, so Nebuchadnezzar doesn't want just the interpretation. He wants them to tell him what he dreamed. You with me? He doesn't want to know just what it means. He wants to know what he wants them to tell him what he dreamt. Now, I've been thinking about this, and I used to think, well, he's just an unreasonable old fart. The guy doesn't know what he's talking about. He's crazy. In fact, we'll find in a couple chapters he is a little bit crazy. He's a little bit a little bit tweaked there, you know. And I used to think, well, maybe it's just an unreasonable thing. Look at verse 29. Skip ahead to verse 29. Daniel's going to talk about Nebuchadnezzar's state of mind when he gets the dream. And he says, as for you, O king, thoughts came to your mind while on your bed about what would come to pass after this. He who reveals secrets has made known to you what will be. See, Daniel says that there was Nebuchadnezzar laying on his bed, drifting off to sleep, wondering, gee, I wonder what's going to happen in the world after this. That's what he's thinking about. He's got this thing churning in him about what's the future? What's the future going to be like? And I think it's pretty reasonable for him, if he's going to try to get the truth from his counselors, I think it's pretty reasonable for him to find out just how much these counselors know about the future. If he wants to know the future, he thinks it's possible to know the future, then if he's going to talk to these guys, I mean, people can just blow smoke at you, right? And they'll just tell you what you want to hear. But Nebuchadnezzar doesn't want them to just tell him what he wants to hear. He wants to know the truth. And how else to know that but to see if these guys can tell him something that nobody else can tell him. Are you following me with the logic on that? How do you know which religion is true? It kind of follows along this line. How do you know which religion is true? How do you know that Christianity is true or better than all the others? Well, it's not just better than all the others. It is true. Now, how do you know that? Well, because I grew up in America. You know, or my parents were Christians, or I like the handsome guy that stands behind the pulpit on Sunday morning, you know, or something like that. No. If that's why you think Christianity is true, I'm sorry, we need to take you aside and talk a little bit more. The Mormons will tell you when they show up at your door and they'll hand you the Book of Mormon and say, well, why don't you read this? And you ask our Heavenly Father to show you whether it is true or not. And I will tell to you that the Book of Mormon is God's Word and Joseph Smith is his prophet. And how do I know? Because I read it and I got the burning in the bosom. In other words, if you think about it, what they're saying is that they know it's true simply because it feels right. And you know what? I think a lot of people in this world live that way. I think a lot of people in the world decide what's true and what isn't by simply what feels right. And you know what, gang? It's a whole lot more. How do I know that the Bible is right and that the Quran is not? How do I know that the Bible is right and that the Book of Mormon is not? I'll tell you what. I'll tell you one good thing you can tuck away here, gang. Because only the Bible contains prophecy. Specific, detailed prophecy written hundreds of years before it would take place and things that have been documented in history as having happened. It is not in any other book. No other collection of religious writings has fulfilled prophecy like the Bible. Now, there are some nut things out there, like was that guy in France that, Nostradamus. You know, people make the goofiest things out of his stuff, you know. But gang, the Bible is 100%. It's clear. It's verifiable. And if this book, see, what is this book doing? This is a book that has told the future. And it came to pass. And because of that, you've got an objective, you've got a factual reason to know that this book is true. And if this book is true about what it predicts, then don't you think it's true when it tells you how to live your life, when it tells you who to trust, when it tells you what Jesus did for you? Don't you think you ought to believe it? If that's how God showed you this is his book. Are you following me with this example? I think that's kind of where Nebuchadnezzar's going with this. Is that his heart is all about what's the future? And what better way to know whether these guys are telling him something real or whether they're just blowing stories and make-believe pretend stuff at him? Well, you tell me something that nobody else can tell me. You tell me not just what my dream meant. You tell me what it was. You with me here? I think this is about truth. So verse 6, However, if you tell the dream and its interpretation, you shall receive. So he says, you know, if you don't tell me, then you're going to be cut in pieces. But if you do tell me, you shall receive from me gifts, rewards, and great honor. Therefore, tell me the dream and its interpretation. They answered again and said, well, let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will give its interpretation. The king answered and said, I know for certain that you would gain time because you see that my decision is firm. Oh, you're just stalling. If you do not make known the dream to me, there is only one decree for you. For you have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me till the time is changed. Therefore, until I change my mind. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can give me its interpretation. The Chaldeans answered the king and said, there is not a man on the earth who can tell the king's matter. Therefore, no king, lord, or ruler has ever asked such things of any magician, astrologer, or Chaldean. It is a difficult thing that the king requests, and there is no other who can tell it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh. And that's the whole point. Nebuchadnezzar doesn't want to hear from men. He wants to hear from God. Verse 12. For this reason, the king was angry, very furious, and gave a command to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. He's kind of an extreme guy, you know. He's all this way or all that way, you know. So he commands all the wise men to be rounded up and wiped out. Verse 13. So the decree went out, and they began killing the wise men, and they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them. Then with counsel and wisdom, Daniel answered Arioch, the captain of the king's guards, who had gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. He answered and said to Arioch, the king's captain, why is the decree from the king so urgent? Then Arioch made the decision known to Daniel. He told him what had happened. So Daniel went in and asked the king to give him time that he might tell the king the interpretation. How's that for guts? He says, give me a couple days, king, and I'll tell you. Then Daniel went to his house and made the decision known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions. He gets his buddies together, gets his praying group together, that they might seek mercies from the God of heaven concerning this secret, so that Daniel and his companions might not perish from the rest of the wise men of Babylon. What a great example, gang. And we know it. We know that we should do it. But I often forget, you know, when I'm totally panicked and I'm facing a impossible situation. I don't have a clue what to do, and I'm freaking out. God says, ask me. Seek him. He's got the answers. James 1:5, if any man lacks wisdom, let him ask of God. You don't know what to do? You ask God. God says in Jeremiah 33, verse 3, God says, call to me, and I will answer you and show you great and mighty things which you do not know. Now, how does that work? What, you get some friends together and you hold hands and you say, oh, God, speak to us. You know, and then the Ouija board begins to move. No. Was there going to be writing on the wall? Well, only in Daniel we'll get the writing on the wall. You know what? I'm not sure I can tell you how it will happen, but it will happen. It will happen. God will speak. God will guide you. It may be through circumstance. It may be through a dream. It could be through an impression. It could be suddenly the answer is in your head. Why didn't I see this before? It will happen. It might be that a friend will share something with you and you go, ah, there it is. That's it. But gang, we need, I wish this would be a knee-jerk reaction for me. Think of all the ulcers I could save. You know, if I could just learn to pray when I'm in trouble. Verse 19. Then the secret was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. In other words, he was awake at night, and he saw something at night. So Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel answered and said, blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his, and he changes the times and the season. He removes kings and raises up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. Now, this part of his thanksgiving, this thing about changing times and removing kings, this he is saying, I believe, because of the vision that he's received. Because the vision is going to be about changing times. It's going to be about changing kings. And so he said, boy, wow, boy, you are an awesome God. Look what you're going to do. I got a glimpse of what you showed Nebuchadnezzar, and I see what you're going to do. You do all these things. Verse 22, God reveals deep and secret things. He knows what is in the darkness, and light dwells with him. I thank you and praise you, O God of my fathers. You have given me wisdom and might, and now have made known to me what we asked of you, for you have made known to us the king's demand. Therefore, Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and said thus to him, do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Take me before the king, and I will tell the king the interpretation. Then Arioch quickly brought Daniel before the king and said thus to him, I have found a man of the captives of Judah who will make known to the king the interpretation. The king answered and said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, are you able to make known to me the dream which I have seen and its interpretation? Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, the secret which the king has demanded, the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, and the soothsayers cannot declare to the king. But there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. Your dream and the visions of your head upon your bed were these. As for you, O king, thought this. So here we have, now we launch into this thing. Now he's going to tell him what the dream was. As for you, O king, thoughts came near to your mind while on your bed about what would come to pass after this, and he who reveals secrets has made known to you what will be. But as for me, the secret has not been revealed to me because I have more wisdom than anyone living, but for our sakes who made known the interpretation to the king, that you may know the thoughts of your heart. He's saying, I'm not anything special. God answered my prayer. You, O king, here it goes. You, O king, were watching, and behold, a great image, or a big statue. This great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. He's dreaming, and he sees this big statue. The image's head was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. You watched while a stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found. And the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. So he sees this image, this statue with all these different materials. This huge stone comes out of nowhere and smashes the thing. And the thing just disappears. It just flies off like dust. And then the stone grows into a big mountain. This is the dream. Now we will tell the interpretation of it before the king. You, O king, are the king of kings. For the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. And wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field and the birds of the heaven, he has given them into your hand and has made you ruler over them all. You are this head of gold. Now, the statue is broken up into sections, and each section will be an empire, a king, a world-ruling empire. And this first part, the head, the gold, represents Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon. But after you, verse 39, shall arise another kingdom inferior to yours, then a third kingdom of bronze which shall rule over all the earth. Now, I'll just cut to the chase. The second kingdom is the Medes and the Persians who conquered the Babylonians. And then the next part, the bronze part, are the Greeks who conquered the Medes and the Persians. Verse 40, and the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters everything. And like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others. The fourth empire is the Roman Empire, which conquered Greece in 65 BC or so. But he says, whereas you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. Yet the strength of the iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay. Now, I think these feet are a fifth group. It's connected to the fourth kingdom. It's even got some of the material of the fourth kingdom. It's got the iron in it, but it's different because it's got iron and clay mixed together. I think that this fifth kingdom, I believe, is still in the future. I'll describe it in a minute. And as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. And you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay. They will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay. This fifth empire has some of the strength of the Roman Empire. It's got the iron in it, but it's got this clay, which he's saying is men, the seed of men. Something humanly is mixed in with this revived Roman Empire. I believe right now, I think the best candidate for this fifth kingdom is the European, what's going on in Europe, the European Union. 25 nations that have banded together that lay on top of the old Roman Empire. There is strength in it. As an economic power, the European Union is scary. It's pretty scary. And yet it's not, doesn't have the strength of a tyrannical ruler like Nebuchadnezzar, because it's 25 separate nations that are all juggling around and deciding who's going to be in charge of this year and all like that. It's interesting that there's 10 toes on the statue. It doesn't talk about 10, but he mentions the toes. Most people have 10 toes. I guess it could be a 12-toed statue, but this is a, I'm assuming it's 10 toes. And it's interesting to note that even though there's 25 nations, last year they talked about breaking the thing into 10 sections, kind of like 10 states. If you follow the thread through the scriptures, we believe that this Roman Empire, this revived Roman Empire, is also the base of operations of the Antichrist. We'll see that when we get to Daniel chapter 7. So, verse 44, and in the days of these kings, because these are things that happen, mentioned in the latter days, and in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Inasmuch as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will come to pass after this. The dream is certain, its interpretation is sure. Then Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face prostrate before Daniel. The great world leader, Nebuchadnezzar, falls on his face before young Daniel. And he commanded that they should present an offering, an incense to him. And the king answered Daniel and said, truly, your God is the God of gods, the Lord of kings, and a revealer of secrets, since you could reveal the secret. Because you know what? It's what he dreamt. And the king promoted Daniel, gave him many great gifts, and he made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief administrator over all the wise men of Babylon. Also, Daniel petitioned the king, and he set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon, but Daniel sat in the gate of the king. In other words, he kept close to the king. Now, it mentioned at the very end that there would be a stone cut out of a mountain without hands. That's Jesus Christ. Jesus is the stone. He's the Psalm 118. He's the stone that the builders rejected. And this picture of this stone coming out of nowhere that smashes this thing, it's a picture of the return of Jesus Christ. And the stone becomes a mountain that just overwhelms everything. Jesus will come back and he will set up his kingdom on earth. On Sunday morning, we're going to be looking at a verse that talks about this in Ephesians 1:10. It says, and this is God's plan. At the right time, he will bring everything together under the authority of Christ, everything in heaven and on earth. The stone will come and smash this kingdom and smash the Antichrist. And Jesus will set up his kingdom. There you go. That's it. Let's stand and pray.